Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Steve Davidson here on behalf of Metropolitan Life. Dan Zollner and John Svoboda are at council table for Ford. We'll be dividing the argument between us. I'll take the first 10 minutes. Your Honors, this is an ERISA case in which the district court went well beyond its proper role when performing judicial review of a claim determination under the abuse of discretion standard, applying an incorrect definition of that standard and reweighing the evidence as if it was making the decision on its own for the first time. That's not what ERISA calls for, and that's why we'll ask you to reverse this morning. I feel compelled to begin with what I think is the most obvious error in the district court's decision, which is its use of a sufficient evidence test in lieu of the proper substantial evidence test. And I saw that in the order, and I thought, well, you know, maybe there's just a typo, just got the word wrong. It's not semantics, and you could tell that from the content of the order. And I think because it really made a difference in how the district court approached the issues in its review on this case. And I think the best example is this five-question health screening form that Mr. Menares completed. It's in the record. The human resource TPA for Ford found it, sent a copy to MetLife, said, here it is, this is the form, here are the answers that Mr. Menares gave to the questions. And MetLife said, great, accepted that as true, and made its claim decision on the basis of that information. District Court disagreed and said things that suggested the imposition of a burden of proof upon MetLife, somehow independent of simply a review of the record that simply is not appropriate under ERISA. The district court's order said things like, MetLife has not shown that the decedent answered no to the questions. MetLife has not proved that Mr. Menares answered health-related questions untruthfully. MetLife had no burden to prove authenticity of underlying documents in front of the district court at this stage. ERISA cases under the abuse of discretion standard of review simply is not a fact-finding exercise. And that's really what Judge Battalion did in his review of this case. It was error not just to use the wrong word, but it was error to impose a burden of proving something more than simply the proper standard of review, which is that the record contained more than a scintilla, but less than a preponderance of evidence in support of the claim determination that MetLife made. And when the plans, you know, designee for processing this life insurance underwriting information tells MetLife, here's the questions, here are the answers, MetLife is entitled to rely upon that. And that is sufficient proof in the record to satisfy the substantial evidence test that the district court should have applied. The second, I think, big picture item I want to emphasize this morning is that it's a completely appropriate exercise for a benefit plan like Ford, hiring an insurance company like MetLife, to choose to say that we're not going to allow employees to obtain optional life coverage unless and until the proper medical information is received by and then evaluated by and then approved by the insurance to establish that the employee is a suitable candidate for additional life insurance from a medical perspective. Remember, this plan has a basic life component and an optional life component. The basic life component is not underwritten. It's a relatively modest benefit. It's $50,000 that was paid to Mr. Menares' spouse in this instance. But the structure of the plan allows the employee an opportunity for the employee's convenience to buy more insurance. It's just like going to an insurance agent, buying more insurance.
So is there additional premium to be paid for the optional life coverage?
Yes, and it's paid by the employee, withdrawn from their paycheck. But to structure your plan such that that coverage can't be issued until you, employee, demonstrate to us that you're medically suitable for this coverage, is an appropriate goal of an ERISA plan. Judge Battalion in his order said, my understanding of the goal of this plan is to provide life insurance to people. Well, we would characterize it a little bit differently. Certainly, that's the goal of the basic life benefit. The optional life benefits goal is to give the employees an opportunity to buy more coverage if and only if they can first establish medical eligibility for that coverage.
Mr. Davidson, do I understand you're suggesting that we send this case back for another trial with the proper burden used? Is that where you're coming from here?
No, Your Honor. Your standard of review is de novo in terms of you conduct your own evaluation as to whether the standard of review is satisfied. Our request is that you complete that review, apply the abuse of discretion standard in the proper way, and find that the claim determination was not an abuse of discretion, and reverse and complete that task yourselves. It doesn't need to go back to Judge Battalion again. You're entitled.
Why don't you address then what is the substantial evidence in the record that you think supports the decision?
Sufficient
evidence isn't a standard. It's just a way. It could be just a way of referring to the standard of substantial. If it's not substantial, it's not sufficient. So what's the substantial evidence?
It begins with the no answers to the five health screening questions, one of which relating to high blood pressure simply was not true. Mr. Menara's had an extensive history of care and treatment for high blood pressure, including hospital visits where he thought he was having a heart attack, regular physician visits where he would run out of medication and would have to go back to his doctors and ask for more. And when he first became eligible for this coverage, he was asked a series of screening questions in order to trigger a more comprehensive underwriting process. One of those questions was, do you have any history of high blood pressure, treatment for high blood pressure? He said no. Because he said no, that underwriting process never occurred. It was never triggered by the health screening questions. And without it, MetLife was unable to evaluate in the first instance whether this candidate for optional life insurance was medically qualified to receive it or not. And the way the plan is structured, coverage never exists. It's never issued in the first place unless and until that medical underwriting process takes place,
The district court seemed to then go on and question what would have happened hypothetically.
Sure.
Is there any materiality requirement in these answers?
There is not under the structure of this plan. And the record is clear that the MetLife underwriter said, from what I have in front of me, I can't tell if we would have issued coverage or not. But the way the plan was set up is to require that the underwriting process itself occur as the prerequisite to the issuance of coverage, not that the outcome go one way or another. And it's because of this multiple step process in enrollment. It starts with the screening questions, and the screening questions are what triggers the more comprehensive medical evaluation. So when an employee says no to everything, the coverage issues, MetLife's underwriting group never does anything, and the coverage goes in place. But when you get the yes answer, that's what causes MetLife to require a statement of health, potentially review of medical records, potentially have the person examined so that it's not taking an unreasonable risk in issuing coverage in the first instance.
But suppose they find out later one of the answers was wrong. Do they reconstruct what would have happened and say this wouldn't have made any difference?
That's not what happens under the structure of this plan because, as I said,
cancel any policy when they find
when they find that underwriting should have happened and didn't, that's the event that causes the coverage to never go into place in the first
place. Is that in the record?
It is. It's
where would we find that?
It's the way in which the plan language is set forth, particularly.
No, I'm talking about the practice of the company. That they automatically cancel whenever there's an incorrect answer to one of the five screening questions? Or is the record that, no, sometimes they leave the policy in place if they decide that it was immaterial.
I don't know that this record goes into deeply into what happens, you know,
does
broadly
it go into it
like
shallowly?
That. There's some emails where it's suggested that every time there's a no question, the policies are issued. But it's when there's a yes question or a yes answer to the screening questions, that's what triggers the additional underwriting process.
Right. No, I understand.
Beyond that, I don't think the record speaks to the question.
About what happens when the company finds out later there's a wrong answer.
We know what, in this case, the decision letter said was, we didn't get to underwrite your file, so your coverage never came to be.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead. Judge Shepard might have a question.
Just a quick one. When the decision was made to deny the claim, was there any provision made for refund of premiums?
Yes. The initial letter said, we will refund your premiums when your appeals are complete. And, you know, as we sit here today, obviously the answer to coverage is still unknown. MetLife will refund the $71 in some sense in premium if and when it's determined that it's not obligated to pay this claim.
Very well. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Zollner, we'll hear from you.
Good morning. May it please the court?
Wait a minute. I think he had 5 minutes. We might have gone over time with Mr. Davidson, but let's give him his full five, please.
Thank you, sir. Daniel Zollner on behalf of Ford. This is a fully insured plan. Ford was the plan sponsor and the plan administrator. MetLife was the claim administrator and the insurer. In this instance, Ford delegated to MetLife the underwriting of the program, the claim determination, and the claim payment. I'd like to address the counts 3 through 5, the breach of fiduciary duty 502A3 claims. As soon as the district court determined that Ms. Sepulveda Rodriguez had a viable claim for benefits under 502A1B, then she should not have been permitted to seek summary judgment or even get judgment on the A3 claims for equitable relief. Those should have been immediately dismissed. It's Hornbook law that you cannot both pursue an equitable claim under A3 and a benefits claim under A1B. In this instance, the district court first found that there were benefits due and payable under A1B and then addressed the A3 equitable claims, and that should not have been done. They should have been dismissed. And without the A3 claims, there shouldn't have been any basis for imposition of attorney's fees against Ford.
What about the penalty?
Go ahead.
Sure.
Well, there's the separate issue of the penalties,
yes,
right?
Sir. Yes, sir. The penalty under 502C. We do not believe that should have been imposed, that it was an abuse of discretion to impose penalties in this situation. The record was undisputed that it was an inadvertent error. The employee who received the first letter requesting the summary plan description quit Ford's employment. The letter was.
Does the statute forbid penalties in the case of negligence by the defendant?
No, sir. It doesn't. It does not.
So inadvertence isn't really a basis to say there's
a. Inadvertence is not a defense. I agree with that, Your Honor.
So what's the abuse of discretion here then?
Once the court undertook to review and exercise its discretion, we believe that the discretion should have been exercised properly. And in this case, the court found that Ford's mistake was inexcusable, but then later found that Ford did not act maliciously or intentionally or in bad faith. So we believe that the record establishes that the mistake was inadvertent. We didn't act intentionally or maliciously to harm the plaintiff. It fell through the cracks, and as soon as we found out that it fell through the cracks, we immediately sent the letter, and we called the attorney and said we're sending the letter. And the letter or sent the summary plan description. And the attorney received the summary plan description before he filed suit, saying he didn't get it. He had it for at least 2 weeks before he sued us under 502C, saying the court should order us to send it.
How should this direct us? I mean, where should this lead us in deciding what are you arguing that we need to do to rectify these problems that you've just outlined?
We believe that the sanctions should be removed, that Ford should not have been sanctioned for a 19-day delay in providing the summary plan description, especially in a situation where it did not cause any prejudice to the participant beneficiary. In this instance, the appeal was handled by MetLife.
You seem to be saying we should state a rule that if the failure was inadvertent and caused no prejudice, then it's an abuse of discretion to impose the penalty. Would that be the opinion you want us to write?
Well, that's the argument that we're making. That once.
But doesn't that conflict with our cases? Is my concern. We have this Star case that seems to say good faith and absence of harm do not preclude the imposition of penalties. So how could we write the opinion that says the opposite?
Because the Star case also says that the court should primarily look at whether or not the defendant acted intentionally, maliciously, or in bad faith, or whether there was prejudice, and whether there was prejudice to the plaintiff. And in this case, she had the summary plan description well before she filed suit. She didn't go back and try and reopen the administrative record to have it redetermined. Her attorney waited 3 months after filing suit to bring the benefits claim. There's nothing that Ford's 19-day delay did to prevent her from seeking benefits in this case.
How much were the penalties?
Originally $20,000, reduced to $2,000, which was the maximum.
$2,000 penalty against Ford?
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, thank you for your argument. Let's see. Mr. Monahan, we'll hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Tom Monahan. I represent the plaintiffs in this matter. Let me start with Ford. There was prejudice. The lawyer who made the applications to Ford ended up getting fired because he couldn't get the documents that he needed from Ford. He spent a lot of time asking MetLife for it. I think there are at least five letters that you can find in the record if you look at the record. And it cost my client a great deal of attorney's fees, actually more than what the penalty would be from Ford Motor Company. So the court did find.
Well,
that there
if he asked the wrong place, why would that be Ford's fault?
I didn't say it was. If it was Ford's fault, then the penalty would have been much higher because the period of time would have been longer. I'm not saying that Ford ought to pay more. I'm saying that Ford ought to pay what the statute requires. That's all I'm saying.
But when it comes to prejudice, what was the prejudice of the 19 days?
Well, when we first get the case, we don't have it because it's with the other lawyer. We finally get it. There was we believe that there was a period of time that we had to file the lawsuit and get going. One, it was difficult to determine which MetLife to sue, what role Ford actually did play. Was Ford just an independent player that employed our client's husband, or were they actively involved in it? And as you could see from the initial complaint, we had it wrong. We had to do an amended complaint. So there was some effort that we had to go through. And besides, the statute's pretty clear. It doesn't say there has to be malice or anything else. And the court did find that there was some prejudice to us in that we didn't receive it on time. Can I now shift? Are there more questions on this?
No, I think not from me. I think maybe you should address the claim against MetLife.
Thank you. We believe that the court applied the law appropriately. The courts give great deference in these types of cases to the employer, and I think that Judge Bajayan did give great deference, but when he started looking at the record, and they went through the record very carefully, it was very confusing, and it was contradictory. There are all sorts of statements within the record indicating that we're not sure whether the five questions, one, were required, Two, were they answered? Do we know exactly what the questions were? Do we know what the answers were? Do we know whether it's the same as the paper version or is it the computer version? And I don't believe that they ever really figured that out. Certainly they found against the issuance of the insurance. Then there were the number of questions. So, all right, let's assume he did answer them wrong. Would they still have granted the insurance? And there's a great deal of conversation. If you go through Judge Bachayan's opinion, he sets it all out as to the confusion of what was going on. And the statements were, well, we don't know. We don't think that, one, that the plan requires this type of questions, or the statement of the insurance requires it. It was confusing back and forth.
But in the end, the company said the plan does require the five questions, and we have received what we believe are answers that the man gave, one of which was not true.
That's right. The company did make a decision.
So why isn't that something that passes muster under an abuse of discretion, substantial evidence standard?
I think the standard is the court will give a great deal of deference to the decisions made, unless it's absolutely wrong. And in this instance, it was wrong, and the court found that it was wrong. I believe that they made the decision to deny insurance before they even knew whether he had completely answered the questions, whether that had been resolved. Certainly, it hadn't been resolved whether or not they would in fact have insured him. The third issue is that they had yearly updates. Ford had yearly updates, and Ford even filed an affidavit. One of their employees filed an affidavit in one of the briefs on summary judgment saying that, well, that has nothing to do with it, and Ford wouldn't have, or MetLife wouldn't have any information regarding this instance because it wouldn't have applied, except it was in the record. MetLife did have it. It was there, and it showed that his conditions in the two subsequent years of medical exams would have shown that his answers of no, if he answered it no, was in fact accurate. So, you know, that's what Judge Bachayan was faced with, was if you simply gave them absolute deference, which I don't believe the court has the right or obligation to do so, then you'd find for Metropolitan. But that's not the court's job. And the court's job in this instance was to take a look at it and see if it did pass muster. And Judge Bachayan sets forth very clearly in his opinion that it doesn't. And this court has a right to look at what Judge Bachayan did de novo. I would encourage you to do that. I would encourage you to read the record.
And if we find that he applied the wrong standard, then what do we do with it?
It's not going to take you long to beat him, but I don't think you'll find that. I think you'll find that his opinion was thoughtful and wise. He also came up with, if you don't, then you have the equitable rights under our claim. I don't have as much faith in those.
To fashion equitable rights, to fashion a result of some kind with all these problems that both sides have set forth?
That's correct. Again, I don't have as much faith in that, and I'm not arguing that. What I'm saying is that what Judge Bachayan did is what the district courts are obligated to do, which is to give great deference to the employer. But if the employer has it wrong, and if you read the back and forth between the underwriters and the business folks, And remember, there is the issue of a conflict of interest when a company like MetLife does both, makes the determination and pays the money out. There is that inherent conflict of interest. But nevertheless, all you have to do is read back and forth between all these people. They didn't know what was going on, and they nevertheless found a way to say, we're not going to give him insurance. we're not going to grant it, and we're going to pay it back when this case is over. I would say that what if you spend the time and look at Judge Battalion's decision, there is no way that you can reverse him.
When you say you don't have much faith in the equitable claims, you're not arguing it. Do you mean you don't argue this equitable claim against Ford that was discussed here briefly? You're focused only on the claim against MetLife.
I'm focused on the claim against MetLife. Ford owes the $2,000.
Oh, but the penalties. That, but the other claims against Ford, you agree those?
If we could have figured out a way to get Ford out of this case without completely getting him out and causing problems for the court and the decision, we might have done that. But Ford wasn't.
I'm just trying to nail down whether you are defending a judgment against Ford other than on the penalties.
No.
All right. Is there anything else you want to say about the MetLife claim, or have you covered?
If you look at the statements that the court had, and he sets them out verbatim from the record, you'll see that this case was decided properly.
What about this point that it's improper to speculate about hypothetically what the company would have done if?
Well, that's what they were doing.
He'd answered the questions.
The company was making those decisions, and they're saying that if you answer them wrong, well, they don't know really whether they're answering them wrong, because they look at the records from before where they say, well, of course he had high blood pressure or he had heart pains or all of that. Well, those were related to other instances. They went away. There was explanation for it. This is by the underwriters themselves saying that. And then there were a number of records that provided indication that there was no coronary problems, there were no high blood pressure problems for the years afterwards. So the question is, which records are you going to take? The other thing is they had my client sign a release. They went back years on records that would normally not be a part of it, but it's still, after all of that, the underwriter said, you know, even if he had answered yes to all of these questions, we'd have still probably given him insurance. So there wasn't any loss to anyone or any damage to anyone. And that's what you look at.
You say you have an underwriter in the record admitting that if the plaintiff had said yes to all the questions, they would have given him insurance anyway?
If my records are, if I can get it.
I mean, the company says that's contrary to their policy, which says you have to go through underwriting.
One from Kay Fleming.
What page are you reading from?
I'm reading from page 14 of Judge Battalion's opinion.
Oh, I thought you were reading from the record.
Well, it is from the record.
All right, he's quoting the record, you mean?
He's quoting the record.
Yeah.
Said they would not request additional documentation unless the employee had hypertension and hyperpedia and was being treated by a cardiologist and being medicated. They also say that upon the medical records, the employee should have stated he had chest pains. The question does not even appear to ask about chest pains. However, the question for have you ever been diagnosed or treated by a physical sick for other healthcare provider does not show the drop downs. Only the next question, which is diagnosed, treated, or given. Is there more to this form where the first question is question mark? Plan master asks whether we ask about chest pains, but this form doesn't show that question. The plan master doesn't state that we has to ask about hypertension, but their questionnaire does. So this is not a complete answer to all of this. You need to read Judge Battalion's decision where he weaves it all together using exactly the words from the underwriters and the directors. As I say, he gave deference to the court, as he should have, but found that there was not a scintilla of evidence and found in favor of the plaintiff on this. And we believe it's a legitimate decision.
All right. Well, we have the substantial record, and we're in a position to review it. So thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Mr. Davidson, I think you used all of your time. We'll give you 1 minute if you have something you're dying to say in rebuttal. Something that would be constructive. Let me put it that way. Anything that would be constructive.
Very briefly, the claim shows you a process of MetLife figuring out what happened. And it was uncertain for a while, but at the end of the day, they figured out what the questions were and what the answer was, and were entitled to rely upon that in deciding the claim. That's number one. Number two.
And that result, and if that's true, the result would be what, in your view?
The result would be that this court would find that the claim determination was not an abuse of discretion and dismiss the case.
And so there'd be no recovery by the plaintiff?
No recovery by the plaintiff on the benefit claim or for attorney fees. The Ford issues are distinct. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you for your argument. The case is submitted, and the court will file an opinion in due course. Please call the next case for argument.
18-1574, 18-1647, and 18-2116 from the District of Nebraska, Philip Petrone et al. V. Werner Enterprises et al.